Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
This week, Setlist live from Wide Days 2023. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt, and this is, well, you may have noticed, our first edition of Setlist in a couple of months. We did say we might take a few weeks off. I don't think we planned on having quite such a break, but we have. It's happened now. This week is a special edition recorded live at Wide Days in Edinburgh. I am not and have not been in Edinburgh this year, but Chris did go, and in place of me, he got three excellent guests to talk through not our usual format, not the biggest and most interesting stories of the last week. This time we're going to talk through some of the biggest and most interesting stories in the music industry from our time off and get some different industry perspectives on them. I'm not going to introduce you to our guests now because they will do that themselves in just a moment. So I guess all that's left for me to do is hand over to Chris in Edinburgh. Over to you, Chris.
So here we go with this special edition of Setlist at Wide Days in Edinburgh. We haven't done a live edition of Setlist for quite some time. In fact, we haven't done an edition of Setlist for quite some time, but we definitely have not done one with guests at an event. But we did do one at Wide Days a year ago, so this is our second time recording an edition at Setlist. We've got three topics to discuss with my guests, but first of all, we should get them to introduce themselves. So we're going to do very, very quick introductions because we've got a lot to cover in our time slot, so we'll get the introductions done super fast. But let's get each of my guests to quickly say hello and explain what it is that you do. So we'll start with Clara. This doesn't make sense for the people listening at home, but Clara's on the far end of the stage, and we'll get just say hello and explain what you do.
Hello everyone, my name's Clara Cullen. I'm the venue support manager at Music Venue Trust, which is a UK registered charity with the aims of protecting, securing and improving grassroots music venues.
Okay, and then sitting next to Clara we've got Tony.
Hi everyone, I'm Tony. I'm head of artist relations and marketing at EMU Bands. We're a digital music distribution company. We help independent artists and labels sell their music online.
And you do that globally, but you are based in Scotland.
Yeah, so obviously with my accent, I'm very Glaswegian. So yeah, that's where we're based. But we work with artists from everywhere.
But I always have an EMU Bands gossip catch-up scheduled into my Wide Days. And this time we're having it on the podcast.
Well, we are, our new recruits, when they start, we tell people to listen to set lists. I better be on my A game. Not make a fool of myself.
And my final guest joining us, we've got Sylvia. Say hello.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Montello. I'm the chief executive of the Association of Independent Music, which is a trade organisation in the UK supporting independent labels, independent rights holders, self-releasing artists, and lobbying to make sure that our sector is supported.
And maybe, although we're not doing long introductions and live stories, just name check some of your previous roles. The reason for that is some of the topics we're going to talk about today, you're going to be delving into your experience and previous roles in your answers.
So I've been in music for 33 years. I have worked at major labels. I've worked at independent labels. I've worked with companies that are publishers as well as recorded music. I have experience in the electronic sector and experience with tech startups providing AI and machine learning solutions for the music industry.
More on which later. But before we get into the mysterious world of artificial intelligence, so as I say, what we're going to do on this edition, because Setlist has been away for a couple of months, I've picked three stories developing things happening in the music industry that keep popping up in the CMU Daily, and I thought we'd just spend 10 minutes on each of them, delving in and getting our guests' perspectives. So the first thing that I've picked, we have talked about this before on Setlist, but it keeps popping up again in the Daily Bulletin, is what is happening in the live sector, because of course we all know what happened during the pandemic to that side of the industry, that overnight shutdown that we all thought was going to be for 3 weeks and then 3 months, and I don't think anybody thought it was going to be 2 years or 18 months actually in the grassroots sector. The grassroots sector got back before the higher end of the market. But I think what is interesting in the live sector is, in parts of the industry, there's a narrative that live music is back. The pandemic's over. We're all in denial that COVID's actually still running rampant, but we ignore it now. And the live industry is back. And there was one thing a couple of weeks ago, the American record industry published their annual report about the American recorded music market and how we've had more growth, more streaming income. And the boss of the American Record Industry Trade Organization, the RIAA, it's always a bit of a mouthful to say, wrote a blog post, and obviously all the label organizations, particularly the major labels, when they're putting out their statements about how well streaming's doing at the moment, always put in a little bit about how artists and songwriters are doing well too. We'll talk more about later to what extent that is true. But one of the things he also said is, and we must remember that artists don't just earn from their recordings, they earn from live. And the line he used is, the live industry is roaring back to success. Pandemic's over, live has recovered. And it's like, well, where's he getting that from? Now, to be fair, if he checks out the quarterly financial reports and statements from Live Nation, the biggest live music company in the world, they are very adamant that live music is back. They are telling their investors that they're selling more tickets than 2019, shows are selling out, there are more shows, sponsors are back, the live industry is being successful again. And if you go to the bankers at Goldman Sachs, and maybe the boss of the RIAA talks to the bankers at Goldman Sachs, I don't think we do, but maybe he does, they are very optimistic about the live sector. Yes, we had that catastrophic 18 months, but growth is very much what's happening in live, and that growth is only going to continue. However, if he was to check out the social media posts of many, many artists, particularly sort of mid-tier artists playing the bigger theater venues, it would be really clear that live is not back. It's back in that people are out going to shows again and performing shows again and touring again. The venues are open, the festivals are back. So yeah, it is back in terms of there's lots of live music to consume and people are consuming it. But the industry is still facing many challenges, some of which were there already, but some of which are a result of the pandemic. So I thought we would just start off by having a little bit of a reality check of what's happening, particularly at sort of the grassroots and the mid-tier of the live sector. So that's obviously where Clara has all of the knowledge of what's happening in the grassroots sector, because you're in that space every day talking to the venues and also the promoters and artists who work at those venues. So in terms of the venues that make up, you know, the membership of the Music Venue Trust and the Music Venue Alliance, what are the challenges that you are seeing out there at the moment? I think it's definitely true that they would not be saying, we're roaring back.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I think as someone working in the grassroots, hearing things like that is, I have to say, really frustrating, because there's this narrative building up that live music is back to recovery when we're not even at stability in the grassroots sector, the grassroots end of things. I'll start with some of the good points, the good news, which is that the sector is worth $500 million. That's incredible. That's really good. We employ over 30,000 people. Also really good. It is a career. It's an industry that you can get into. That's about where it ends with the good news, I'm afraid. We're operating on a 0.2 profit margin at the moment.
My 0.2%.
Sorry, 0.2%. Yeah. My team and my fantastic team run the emergency response service, which is a service that the charity runs when venues are in trouble, and they can come into the service. We try and resolve their cases, so they're really on the front lines of hearing from venues on a day-to-day basis, and it's really, really tough out there. Everything from increased noise complaints, noise abatement orders being issued, difficult rent reviews, and just uncertainty as to whether a show is going to go ahead, will anyone turn up. There's been a nosedive in advance ticket sales. That's very difficult then to plan your entire staffing infrastructure around a grassroots level. And what we are seeing is that those risky shows where you might normally do three new bands on a 10 quid ticket, those aren't really happening anymore, because you have to have some kind of certainty as to whether you're going to get people through the door. And those risky shows, the ones where you might go see someone and you might be at one of 10 people in a room and a dog and the landlord, those ones aren't happening, and that could have a really devastating impact on grassroots music and grassroots scene, because the importance of grassroots as a ecosystem, as a sector, is really important to the general infrastructure and economy of the UK, absolutely. But it's also where you go and see those niche bands, and where you go and see bands that might never actually cross over to the mainstream. And if you can't take those risks. You can't promote those really interesting, potentially groundbreaking, scene-making kind of music that you might all talk about in 10, 15 years' time. You're just not going to get access to that. And it's about cultural parity. It's about having access to affordable, accessible culture that changes your life, which is what happens at a grassroots music venue. And so it is quite a depressing picture at the moment. I'm not going to... I try to tend to be quite optimistic, but I can't come on here and just spout that. We are going through very difficult times, and it is worrying.
Now, the live sector has always been very top-heavy, and I think, you know, there was always that narrative of, particularly when the record industry was going through the bad times in the 2000s and the recorded music money was in decline, oh, artists make all of their money out of live. And, you know, at a certain level, live is incredibly lucrative for artists. But I think we know at the grassroots, even in the best of times, it's a challenging space to be in. So of those things that you sort of listed as the particular challenges at the moment, to what extent are those challenges that grassroots venues have always had to deal with? And to what extent are they either new challenges or worse challenges because we are still basically recovering from the pandemic?
I think some of the challenges predate COVID, so things like noise complaints. So my team, we always see noise complaints as a running theme of one of the things that venues come towards us with, and that's been a trend since 2018 when I took over running the service, but definitely one that is still going on. But what I think COVID did was exacerbate just the insecurity actually at the grassroots level. It's always difficult to make that economic work because actually, if you studied economics, you'd be making more money running it as a restaurant or as actually anything other than a grassroots music venue. And so that is a systemic challenge. It's a challenge for the entire music ecosystem, the entire music industry. And you know, I am a passionate believer that it does start at the grassroots. And I saw bands at my local venues that have now closed down that changed my life. And it's about getting into that and allowing the next generation to have that. But I do think COVID definitely exacerbated some of those systemic problems, and I think it needs a response from the entire music industry if we want to get even to a position where we can say we've stabilized. I honestly can't see that happening for at least 3 years. I think we are on a long road, and what I am hopeful is that we're hearing lots of more conversations from the wider music industry about recognizing it as an ecosystem, and I think that's really, really interesting, and that makes me feel quite positive.
We'll come on to some of those initiatives in the industry or indeed within government in a moment. But I thought I might just bring in Sylvia here, because obviously the AIM community, although you have sort of labels and distributors at the heart of the membership, the independent community is a community where people wear many hats. So many people are labels, but they're also venues or promoters or studios. And I mean, are you seeing that same thing, that this narrative of it's all fine, it's all back, actually, it may be at those big shows, but in the middle, a lot of support is still needed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at the middle and at the bottom end, and for more niche genres as well. So, yeah, there's an incredible pinch at the moment on live for a lot of labels, and as you say, labels that also are promoters, put on festivals and shows themselves. And the pressures are coming in from all sorts of different directions. I mean, you know, the grassroots venues disappearing is a huge concern, because you're right, you know, we are part of an ecosystem, and if independent artists and independent music is kind of the grassroots of the recorded music sector, where do those artists perform? How do they get onto the live ladder? They don't go straight to playing Wembley Stadium. They have to hone their craft playing in those smaller venues and learn how to perform well and build their fan base that way. So that's an incredible challenge. But then the other challenges are around just the cost of living crisis as well. The cost of playing live has gone up. Everything from the petrol that you put in your van to tour around the UK to the cost of food, the cost of accommodation has probably gone up somewhere between 50 and 100% since pre-COVID. So there are lots of other economic challenges, which means that, you know, especially the sort of smaller independent labeled artists or self-releasing artists are looking at it thinking, well, if we run the maths, we can't afford to go on tour because we are going to lose money. We're not going to make the money to help you know, bump up our music revenue overall with streaming and everything else. We're not going to be able to sell merch in the same way because we're not playing live. And it's a huge, huge issue and a big hole that's being left. And, you know, if we want to make sure that the top end of live, where you get, you know, Elton John playing his farewell tour and ticket prices are, you know, however many hundreds of pounds they may be, well, you know, he has to start somewhere. I remember the first time I saw Elbow. They were playing at the Richmond Pub in Brighton, 150 capacity. It changed my life. It also helped to change their lives because they then did upscale into being signed to a major and doing stadium shows. But would they have been able to do that without that grassroots level? I don't think they would. And there are so many niche genres and independent artists who are making fantastic music that is never going to be mainstream and it's never going to be arena shows. And that's okay. That isn't the only aspiration that artists should have. They should be able to find their tribe and have that connection with fans, whether it's 20, 500, 1,000, whatever it might be. So, yeah, the live crisis is a real one. And then obviously consumers are pinched by not being able to afford to buy drinks when they go out live because drinks are so expensive, tickets are expensive, their rent has gone up, that people are making choices. Can we afford to go to gigs even if we want to? Or do we just have to make sure that we can pay the bills and keep a roof over our heads?
Absolutely, and there's this decision you have to make if you're going to go to an arena or stadium show where that might be your entire family entertainment budget for the month or 2 months or whatever in one gig, you know, and so that is a choice you have to kind of sit and think about, and that comes into play when you're sitting there having your conversations.
And I think, yeah, what you both said there, because I guess if you're a harsh economist listening and Sylvia's listing all of the ways in which the costs of touring are going up, so you know, if fuel and accommodation, et cetera, et cetera. And then also the venues costs are going up, the energy bills are spiking. And so a harsh economist will say, well, put your ticket prices up. But for the reasons you've just explained, that you certainly at the mid-tier and the grassroots, that's not really an option. It's a hugely competitive market with so many people touring post-COVID. There's a cost of living crisis. And there is that danger that people start making that choice of, okay, well, maybe I'll go to one big arena show a quarter and that's it, rather than going to 10 grassroots shows in the same time period.
Or, you know, put all of your money into going to a festival where you can see a whole array of bands at one point for 100, 200, even £300 if you're going to Glastonbury. But if you think about the economics and the value for money, I can see why, especially the younger cohort now, are probably more likely to go to a couple of festivals a year because it provides better value for money. They will see more artists. They will get to hang out with their friends. They can probably bring their own drinks and food to make it a little bit more affordable. And that's a real danger as well.
Before we move on from the live conversation, I guess let's talk about some of the solutions, whether those are industry-led or government-led. I mean, I guess we can just observe that in most cases, 20% of the ticket money is VAT and is immediately going to the government. So there's clearly a bit of room for manoeuvre there, and that's long been a request from the music industry. Actually, there was a cut to the VAT on tickets during the pandemic. In many other countries, that's just part of being in the live business. Could we not get that? So I mean, that's an obvious way the government could help. But maybe just talk us through, from a Music Venue Trust perspective, some of the other initiatives and campaigns that you guys are working on.
Sure. So we've just concluded a pilot phase of our campaign called Own Our Venues, which the origins of that is actually why we're called Music Venue Trust. When we first started in 2014, we wanted to be like the National Trust, but for grassroots music venues. And then we were observing what people were doing around the world, and community ownership was becoming more and more of a trend, particularly with things like small community pubs and village pubs and things like that. And then we thought, okay, well, why don't we use that model, because it's quite successful, and centralise it and basically draw on our assets, which is like local live music lovers, local communities, the music industry, funders. Let's all bring them into one entity and do it on a kind of wider scale. So we've just spent a year or over a year fundraising for that. We've raised over 2 million for Own Our Venues. That's going to go towards 9 pilot venues. And it was just a kind of a proof of concept of actually people do want to be active stakeholders in preserving their local live music.
And I guess quickly on that, I suppose, and obviously you guys at Music Venue Trust have really sort of educated everyone on this, is the vast, vast majority of grassroots venues do not own their buildings. They are answerable to a landlord. And, you know, we can paint landlords as those sinister, mysterious figures, but actually, you know, they can be perfectly decent, responsible landlords, but they've gone been through a pandemic. They need to maximize their assets. And so you come up for a rent review, and that is, you know, when you're talking about those tiny profit margins, that can kill venues. Whereas if you have an owner who is not there simply to mostly, they're not going to lose money, but they are there because they want live music to prosper. It takes away one of the big insecurities of running a venue.
Yeah, it takes away a kind of inherent conflict that may exist there, where if you have a landlord who wants the building and wants the venue operator to run it as a grassroots music venue or cultural building or whatever, and advocates and wants that, that's a really healthy way to do that. And if you can do it through a community initiative where people feel like they're coming along with you in that journey, and then they have a stake in their local venue, because it is about music and it's about live bands, but it's also where you might meet your partner or where you might meet your best friends, or, you know, and it's that kind of, I always say that grassroots music venues are almost like secular churches, because you come together and you dance and you sing, and there's something really kind of cathartic about that. And I think the idea of doing that in your local community, regardless of what your political affiliations is, there's something really powerful in that as a movement and as a kind of narrative. So yeah, we did own our venues to try and solve what is quite a difficult conflict. In the emergency response service, which is the service I run, always the really, really difficult cases are actually the ones where it comes down to just an inherent conflict between the venue operator who wants to run the building as a grassroots music venue and the landlord who doesn't really care at all what the use of the building is. So we're trying to use Own Our Venues as a way to resolve that tension and use this idea of community ownership. And it's been really, really heartening to see how many people have backed it, how many people in the music industry has backed it, and see it as this kind of solution. So that's one of our big campaigns. I could go on more, but I know we're limited in time. So
maybe just quickly one last thing, because you're talking there about industry support. So there is also a campaign within the MBT that maybe the bigger shows, the bigger venues could be contributing to what's happening at the grassroots, which is almost like the label model, which is that the superstars help subsidise the new talent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer, and everyone that I talk to who has come up through the grassroots and appreciates that talent pipeline gets it. You don't just walk out onto Wembley Arena or any of the arenas or stadiums. You have to go and practice and sometimes fail and sometimes, you know, really learn how to work a crowd, and you do that in grassroots venues. And then when you hopefully, you know, graduate to theatres and concert halls and up and up and up, that's when you can kind of start broadening your fan base. But it all starts at the grassroots, and I think what my sector wants is recognition of the risk you take when you're having to book a band and don't know if anyone is going to turn up. And that's really hard, because, you know, a lot of bands, they might decide, okay, maybe that's not for me. But a few will break through, like Elbow, and go on to do incredible things, and they're massive supporters. And that link needs to be recognised, and that risk needs to be recognised, and it should be financial. It should be a financial link between what we do at the stadiums and the arenas and what we do down here in the grassroots.
Okay, I'm now going to move us on to our second topic of conversation. So we've looked at what's happening on the live side. Let's flip over to the recorded and the right side, and streaming in particular. And at the start of the year, Lucian Grange, the boss of Universal Music, biggest music rights company in the world, put out a memo to his staff. He does this every year. He sends a memo out to his staff where the first half is, oh, Universal's brilliant, or brilliant artists, or brilliant success. It's brilliant. No one's interested in that. What we're interested in is the second half of the memo, where he basically sets out what his priorities are for the year. And this year, he basically started talking about the way the streaming business model works and raising some issues with it, which was interesting because the artist and songwriter community have been raising issues with the streaming model for quite some time now. So it was interesting to see the boss of the biggest music rights company, record company in the world, also raising some issues, even though it seems to everyone else that if one company's doing really well out of streaming, it's a Universal Music Group. So Lucian Grange called for what he calls an artist-centric model to streaming rather than the current model. I mean, who could possibly argue with an artist-centric model? It sounds good, doesn't it? Although he hasn't really explained what that means. And since that memo came out, Universal has announced a partnership with Tidal and with Deezer to experiment on some possible different models for sharing out the money. Because streaming's a revenue share business, remember. The streaming services share their income, whether that's ad income or subscription income, with the industry. But how is it shared? And so that has been a conversation for years, but it's really become another conversation because of what Lucian Grange said at the start of the year, these partnerships with Deezer and Tidal. When the IFPI report, the big stats report that's published every year that sets out the revenue growth from the previous year, when that was published, more growth, particularly in streaming, but Lucian Grange's bit of the report was, oh, but the model needs addressing. We need to help music makers stand out from the noise, was the line that he was using. So I thought, given that that's remaining a talking point at the moment, it would be worth sort of delving into that. So I'm going to come to Tony next. I mean, obviously, with a company like Emu Bands, you are helping, you know, a huge community of DIY artists, self-releasing artists. Some of those are the grassroots, the people starting out in their career. Some are hobbyist musicians who don't want to be full-time musicians. They just love making music, and at the end of the process, they post it onto streaming services using services like yours. Some are artists who are actually quite established and quite successful and have just decided they're at a point in their career where they want to release through an Emu Bands platform. So for the different parts of the Emu Bands community, does the current model work, or is Lucian Grange right that there are some issues that we need to address?
The current model definitely has issues, but it works for a considerable number of our artists, and that's not just like the superstars. We have a few of those. It rewards volume of stream. So like, obviously the bigger the artist, the more that they're going to earn, but then that comes with, they're not going to be a single artist label typically, so they're sharing that money amongst lots of people, so that's less in their pocket. The artists that we have on our system that do really, really well out of it are those that don't have a big team and their volume of streams are large. They're obviously rarer than the like tons and tons of bedroom artists that exist, or the hobbyists that exist that you see. But the ones that do the best out of it are those that own their own masters and they're on a fair, transparent distribution deal where they're getting the lion's share of the streaming income, is a bit as succinct as I could say it.
And I guess the key point to stress there is we know streaming works for the superstars because things always work for the superstars. But there is sometimes a narrative that only the superstars make money from streaming. But there are, you know, and okay, they may be the minority of the millions and millions of people putting up music onto Spotify, but there is a community of independent artists. Now, whether they are truly independent in that they are running their own label and working with Emu Bands, or maybe they're working with a smaller, more traditional independent label, there are also independent artists out there who are getting, well, to make money from streaming, to make decent money from streaming, you need, first of all, to be getting millions of streams a month, and then you need a good deal with your label partner that you're seeing a decent portion of that money. But those artists do exist who are independent, and they're getting those millions of streams, and they're making decent money.
Yeah, I think from like personal experience, the artists on our system who are making like a considerable chunk per month on a monthly basis, they're making enough to pay their rent and more, you know. Like they tend to be digital natives. They're people who have started making music while streaming has existed. They're not from a pre-streaming era, so they understand it as a musician and as a fan. And so they've also really, really nailed the like fan artist partnership. They really understand their fan base. They know how to sustain listenership. I think like it's micropayments, right? So the more that you can encourage people to come back time and time again, they're giving them reasons to do it. The pattern in which they release music is all geared towards bringing people back in. They're following these best practices. They're almost completely obsessed by it, you know. which I guess if you were on a label, that would be the marketing people that would be doing that, but they're doing that themselves. But the people that do really, really well out of it are they do tend to be artists that have, they're no strangers to streaming themselves. They've grown up with streaming, basically.
And I guess the key point there, and I think, you know, throughout, obviously before Lucian Grange entered this party, the whole economics of streaming conversation that's been ongoing, particularly here in the UK. And I think, you know, quite a few people involved in that, myself included, in that conversation, there is something that we do keep saying, okay, the narrative is not that streaming doesn't work for anybody or it only works for superstars. Yes, there are lots of, I think everybody would agree, there are a number of issues and we need to address those issues. Some of them are the issues that Lucian Grange are raising. But at the same time, there are some great independent artists out there making a living from music, and we have to be really careful that we don't meddle with the system and screw it up for those artists.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's been like, some conversation recently in the press about equitable remuneration, and you know, people, a lot of people are touting that as a solution to the whatever their problem is, basically, right? But every new solution that comes along has its own set of problems, and people are going to lose out. There's going to be winners currently that are going to lose out in this new model. They're not all massive corporations, right? Like, my own worries with a new system like ER is that as soon as you involve the CMOs, as great as they are, it's going to take independent artists longer to get the money than they get right now directly. Right
now, obviously, here on Setlist, if you're a regular listener, we've talked about ER and equitable remuneration a lot, but basically it would mean that some, or maybe all, but probably some of the streaming money would flow through the collective licensing system, so through CMOs, as you say. So in the UK, that would be PPL. It's one of the things, the proposals on the table. That's very much not what Lucian Grange is proposing, because he would be very against that. But I guess, I mean, as Silvia, I mean, I guess, you know, obviously this conversation has been ongoing for years, and actually this conversation is many different conversations, and often that's the problem. There's all these different issues and they all get mangled together and it's hard to come up with solutions. But I guess in terms of what Lucian Grange was talking about, what specific issues do you think he was trying to hone in on?
Well, I mean, that's a fascinating question. And, you know, in the last couple of months in particular, I've heard lots of different people from, especially across the independent sector, but not exclusively, trying to second guess exactly what Lucian Grange was driving at. And that has ranged from, oh, well, okay, it's all about wanting major label repertoire to have a premium streaming rate over independent label repertoire. So that was one kind of fear that I've heard voiced. There's another that is talking about, well, actually, what he is worried about is the proliferation of, let's call it, utility audio or utility music or non-music content on some of the major platforms, and how that is either detracting from royalties being paid out to music that is created by genuine artists, or it's just eating into the listening time that people have on those platforms.
And I guess just to clarify that kind of content, so we're not talking about podcasts there, because podcasts is treated separately by Spotify, but it's white noise, it is rainfall, it is that smooth music, that ambient music that people are using generally for functional purposes rather than entertainment and passion. It's to help people sleep, help people relax, to get the kids to sleep. It's that sort of content.
That kind of utility, absolutely. And where it's actually quite difficult in many ways is that kind of utility music is also being created by genuine music artists. So it's a very grey area in terms of saying, oh, okay, well, all of that is just kind of noise. It's not real music. So there isn't a kind of defined cutoff point there. Other people now are thinking, well, maybe he's, you know, concerned about streaming fraud and streaming manipulation, which quite rightly everybody in the industry should be concerned about, because that is a genuine huge threat and exponentially growing threat in terms of fraudulent streams of other people's copyrighted content, which can appear and draw down an incredible amount of money very, very quickly before people actually realise what it is and take it back down again. So he could be talking about all of those things. For full disclosure, the major label that I worked at was Universal. I did work with Lucian Grange, so I know him a little bit as a human being. And, you know, when all of these theories are going around, I'm thinking, okay, well, what do I know about Lucian? Lucian is an A&R man at heart. and a music person at heart. Now, I'm not saying that that means he's the biggest altruist in terms of spreading the love across the whole ecosystem, but I have been sort of subtly reassured by some people within that camp that it's not about major label stuff has more value than DIY artist music. I don't think that's what it's driving at, but it is definitely looking at the utility, the non-music stuff and the monetization of that. I'm also hoping that he means we need to get the devaluation of music reversed, because music has been devalued on streaming platforms in the last 15 years. You know, the subscriber amounts, the subscription amounts have not kept up with the rate of inflation or anything else, whilst the amount of volume of content has exponentially increased. So the value of a stream is going to continue to be lower and lower unless we do something to actually make sure that people are paying more what they should be paying for access to that music.
So you mentioned in the middle there the sort of the fraudulent content. So that's the content that is uploaded by scammers who are just gaming the system, and they have machines listening to that content, whether it's music or other audio. They don't really expect any normal subscriber to actually listen to that content. They've got computers to do the listening, and then it's all about pulling more money out of the system that you put in. And we've talked about that a lot on Setlist. It has been an issue for a while. And I guess, I mean, coming back to Tony now, because I suppose in terms of the people on the ground that are trying to stop that, the streaming services are doing some stuff. I think probably we would agree there's quite a lot more the streaming services could do. But at the moment, the front line on that are basically companies like Emu Bands.
Yeah, very much so. We spend way more time than I would like to on streaming fraud, combating it when, you know, detecting when, hopefully catching it before it's distributed. Or looking at royalties as they come in and working out, you know, that doesn't look right, or, you know, comparing it to normal listening figures or whatever. A ton of what we have to do is manual work, right? So we have to just rely on our own intuition or, you know, experience of, you know, decades worth of putting out music and trying to catch this stuff. But it's like whack-a-mole, honestly. Like, you know, you sometimes you get three or four like different accounts basically signing up, and they're the same person but they're using different names, and it's really sophisticated basically. The DSPs are now doing something about it, which is great. Like Spotify and Apple, for example, are pretty good at it. Apple just very recently started to kind of get their act together with it. Apple used to sort of tell you 3 months after it's happened that, you know, this has been fraudulently generated, and then be like, we want the money back, you know, 3 months after they paid you for it. But Spotify are great at detecting it. They zero rate the streams as they come in. It makes it less attractive for someone that's trying to do it. Obviously, it's not happening for 100% of the material, otherwise no one would do it. But that's the approach that I would like to see other DSPs adopt. It's not so that I or our company stop reviewing everything that comes in. It's definitely like a two-tier approach that needs to happen. More conversation needs to happen between distributors. I think like that's a big thing. We take down the material, we ban the person from Emu Bands, they go and sign up on TuneCore, they do the same thing again. We don't share that data between each other. There's nothing that, you know, there's no like...
And it's a competitive marketplace. There's a lot of other platforms to go to.
We don't speak to each other. We kind of like pretend that we hate each other or whatever, right? Like,
but I hear that those conversations are now becoming more...
Yeah, very, very soon. We're... the BPI have kind of got all the angry distributors together and getting us to chat together and... be friends about it. Yeah, so but yeah, those conversations are at an early stage, but I'm feeling pretty positive about that. I think that's a way that, yeah, we've always thought that would be a good thing to do.
When we were prepping for this podcast and we were chatting between the three of us, Clara actually asked a question sort of saying, okay, because obviously you're much more focused on the live side, but you were saying, what happened to user-centric or fan-centric? Because you felt as a consumer, as a fan, that idea seemed attractive to you.
Yeah, I think for me it's just quite a romantic idea of fandom, of kind of how I first got into music, of being really obsessed by certain bands or certain genres. And I like from a romantic idea, the idea of if I listen to Fountains of Wayne, which I listen to a lot, I want those artists to get my money, actually. As someone who doesn't have a huge knowledge in streaming, I just was thinking, what's happened to that as an idea? Where are we at with it? I'll pass over to my industry colleagues who know much more about this.
Yeah, so a few years ago, user-centric was a big talking point. Deezer really pushed it, then SoundCloud really pushed it. And we've talked about it a lot here, so I'm not going to explain what user-centric is now because we don't have time, but Andy, my colleague, in the notes that accompany the podcast, is going to link you back to the podcast 2 years ago where we explained it. But I guess in terms of... the other reason I'm bringing up user-centric now is it would actually stop some of the scamming, because some of the scams are exploiting the current system that allows you to pull more out in royalties than you put in by buying subscriptions. So I guess we can ask both Tony and Sylvia, and you, where do you see the user-centric conversation? Is it going to happen? Have people decided actually it's not the panacea that maybe it was presented as 5 years ago?
I still think there's work to be done in terms of exploring user-centric, because there are different models within a user-centric model. And I don't think we should just look at what hasn't been seen to be necessarily working so far. But let's explore how that could work from the subscription price perspective and the fans perspective, but also we need to, on the flip side, the boring industry side, is actually looking at it from the administration perspective, and that's something that has been brought up before, that it's a beautiful idea. I would love it to work, because I would love what I listen to 99% of the time, which is drum and bass, for my subscription to go towards the drum and bass artists I listen to and not to go towards somebody like Ed Sheeran, who I never listen to. No offense, Ed Sheeran, you're great, you're just not my thing. But the admin problem is, are the platforms actually set up to be able to look at every single subscriber and track absolutely what they have played, and then have the administrative and operational capacity to pay out correctly on that basis? The answer to that is no, not yet. I'm hoping, because I'm an optimist, that if we do some more modelling, which AIM are looking to commission some more modelling around user-centric, because ER has been looked at quite a lot, but let's look at other models and whether or not they would work, where they create new winners and losers. Hopefully, we don't want to create more losers. We want to create more winners and a genuinely fairer system. But we do need to think about where the industry and where streaming might be in 5 or 10 years' time. Streaming is still in its infancy in the grand scheme of things. I know it's 15 years, but there is still so much more that can happen with the remuneration models. And hopefully, if we get to that point where fans really feel like their money is going to the artist that they love, that can help propagate more subscribers and make sure that we've got more true fans going forward who actually care about the music they're listening to. And I think that would be very important.
Although, if I'm second-guessing Lucian Grange, I don't think user-centric's on his priority list, not least because I mentioned he's done a partnership with Deezer and Tidal. Deezer were the big champions of user-centric. Actually, Tidal then also became a champion of user-centric. And they've both kind of basically admitted that on this project they're doing of Universal to reinvent the model, user-centric is not on the agenda.
Yeah, and the way that they did user-centric, I mean, the Tidal version of user-centric was... a bit of your subscription will go to the one artist that you've played the most. That's not really user-centric, is it? I mean, that means that the rest of your subscription is just continuing to go according to pro rata, market share, et cetera, et cetera. So I think just saying user-centric doesn't work, it's like, well, your version of it doesn't work, but there are other versions that can still be explored, maybe not by Lucian Grange and Deezer, but by other parties. And I'm optimistic and hopeful that that is not going to be taken off the agenda at this point.
Final of my three topics, another thing that's become almost a talking point to such an extent it's almost laughable, of just how obsessed everyone's become with AI, and specifically generative AI. So there's AI technologies which can create content, and obviously from a music perspective, it's the AI technologies that can compose and record and produce music, none of which is new. It's been around for years. We've been talking about it for years. But I think two things have happened, which is A, the technology is currently leaping. It's getting ever more sophisticated as each week and month goes by. It is partly the ChatGPT effect that was, for a lot of people, their first time seeing that kind of AI. AI in action, and everyone got very obsessed by that. But it does feel that although these are not new conversations, it's really a focus at the moment, is this generative AI, and it keeps popping up in recent weeks. And there are various copyright questions this AI raises. These are new questions. We've been talking about them for years, but things like, should an AI-created work be protected by copyright, like a human-created work? What if it's an AI-assisted work? So there was a human being involved, but actually most of the work was done by a piece of technology. Then other questions, I mean, the way AI works, this generative AI, is it crunches data from existing music in order to create new music. And there's then the questions about, well, hang on a second, do you need to get permission to do that crunch? The industry would like to, if you know, you do need to get permission. Some of the lawyers working for the AI companies have a different interpretation of the law. But maybe I'll come to Sylvia. I mean, obviously, you're relatively new in the job at AIM, but it does sort of feel you've arrived when AI is very much at the top of everyone's talking list.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the, I think probably in week two of being at AIM, we were working with UK Music, who were looking at a government proposal on text and data mining. And the proposal was around taking any protection off companies being able to data mine music, copyrighted music.
So they'll be able to do it for free,
they'd
basically
be able to do it for free without permissions to feed the machine to be able to then generate more AI music. So obviously that was something that everyone kind of geared into to place and went back to the UK government going, do you understand the risks of what you're doing? The UK being a country where we have such a strong music creation from our human beings, you know, in the context of the global music industry, this would be a disaster for UK music creatives. So that was a very sort of early conversation, and it looks like that has been at least paused. It was a Liz Truss idea, so that it was easy for them to pause that idea for now. But we don't think it's gone away. And the government are talking about wanting the UK to be a sort of epicentre for AI development. So that brings a lot of nervousness in terms of, well, what does that mean? What's the effect of that on not just music, but other creative industries? But to your point about AI-assisted music and the copyright issue, I mean, this is something that this is a live conversation we have at the moment. If you've got a human being who uses AI as part of their music making, at what point does it remain human-created or AI-assisted? Is there a cutoff point? And where do you draw that line? Does it have to be over 50%, or can they have literally written one chord? So that's where the copyright piece gets incredibly complicated. But, you know, another thing that sprung up very recently is the Human Artistry Campaign, which is like a sort of 10-point plan that a lot of organisations globally have signed up to, which is just wanting to protect human artistry in music from AI-generated music taking over the world. So, yeah, everyone seems to be jumping on this, and we have to be very clear, AI, as in and of itself, is not the problem. There are so many AI tools that are really fundamentally important to the creative industries, solving problems and assisting with recommendations and assisting people discovering music. So we can't just say AI is bad. That would be foolish. But AI-generated music taking over from human-generated music, that's what we're having to battle with now.
Tony, you're following this. Are you and also sort of, I guess, the artist community that is part of the Emu Bands community, are people generally pessimistic or optimistic about how AI is going to impact on the making and releasing of music?
I am personally terrified. That's a personal opinion. It keeps me up at night. I'm like, what am I going to do in the next 10 years when I lose my job? I don't know. I haven't had deep enough discussions about it, to be honest, to answer about it in any sort of equivocal terms. But obviously, I think, I was talking to my colleague about it before this podcast, was like, the issue is that you're never going to develop fandom with something that doesn't exist, right? So like, you're always going to need the human being element of that.
And I guess even if there is some sort of avatar that is the front, it probably needs human creativity around the personality of the avatar.
I just, I, I think you're always going to have that, like, people are still going to be in love with other human beings, you know, so that's like what the fandom experience totally is, right? And I don't think we're going to lose that. I mean, I think it's right to try and protect it for sure, but like, I can't see that going away.
And I guess particularly for sort of the more DIY artist community, I think one of the, obviously you were mentioning there are big upswings as well as the challenges. And I think one of the things, I was at South by Southwest, and that's actually where that Human Artistry campaign was launched. And I was talking to a couple of people there, and what they're interested in is the new AI tools which are helping people create visuals and artwork and photography and videos. And for those DIY artists who come on the workshops that we do on fan base building, and you can see their hearts sink when we say, making music's not good enough. Okay, if you want to be a musician, you've got to do more than music. You've got to do the videos, the images, the illustrations, and that you can just see they're thinking, that's not why I'm here. The fact that maybe AI can do a big chunk of that work, that's a brilliant thing.
I mean, AI is probably going to be a massive part of the biggest music industry problem that we've ever had, which is metadata and the quality of the metadata. So bear with me. I know metadata sounds terribly dull, but it's the way that people get paid, and the metadata across the music industry has been shocking because of the way that we've managed it collectively. We're all to blame with this. And AI and machine learning can do in a split second the kind of cleanup and the kind of conflict resolution of poor data that it would take thousands of humans to do at a cost. So we have to think about AI as a tool for good, which is solving some of these music industry problems, solving problems for DIY artists as well, creating visual content when you don't have a budget to pay somebody to make you a video, ChatGPT to write your marketing exists. I'm just going to leave it there. I'm just going to leave it there. But there are lots of tools. There are tools that can help you tag your music so that it's more easily findable for sync or licensing purposes. AI and machine learning can be really, really valuable. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater if we use it for those purposes. And you know, registration of metadata, making sure that you're actually gathering all of the revenue from your different revenue streams. All of that stuff can be facilitated. And the smaller you are as an artist or a label, the more those sorts of tools can be hugely cost effective and time effective. So yeah, there is a big uplift in using AI in the right way to counterbalance the threat of the machines taking over and us all losing our jobs and nobody making proper music anymore.
So maybe you can sleep tonight, Tony, knowing maybe the good things are coming. In 10 years, the robots will take over. We've got a good decade.
A good decade.
And we're going to make some great music in that decade. We're almost out of time on the podcast, so I'm going to wrap it up there. But I do feel, given that setlists have been away for a couple of months, we've done a good job of catching up on three of the really big ongoing conversations in the music industry, which is all of the challenges in the live sector, that all the conversations around streaming, particularly kickstarted by Lucian Grange's memo earlier this year, but all of the other conversations that have been ongoing for much, much longer than that, and the fact that AI has become such a big talking point. So we will wrap it up there. So maybe I will just thank you, my guests, for joining us on this live recording. Edition. It's not that we're live streaming it. I never know when you went to use live in the context of a podcast, but a live recording of the podcast. So thank you very much. And maybe for my audience here at Wired Days, a quick round of applause for my panel.
Well, there you have it. That is our special edition of Setlist, recorded live at Wired Days 2023 in Edinburgh. Thank you very much to Wired Days for hosting the recording. Thank you to our excellent guests, Clara, Tony and Sylvia, for coming and giving their insights. And I guess thanks to Chris too for hosting the whole thing in place of me. Thanks to the audience as well. Thanks to the audience for turning up, because that's always a good thing when you're doing a live recording, when people turn up to see it. And that's very nice of them. Thank you all. And yeah, this should be the triumphant return of Setlist now, back in your podcast player automatically every Monday morning. It will be returning to the normal format next week. Me and Chris talking to each other about the previous 7 days in the music industry. You know the format by now. Maybe you don't. Maybe that was the first edition of Setlist you ever listened to. And it's not normally like that, but it was very good. If it is your first time listening and you've not yet subscribed, subscribe to the show right now so that you can get next week's episode automatically as it comes out, 7 a.m. Monday morning, as it will from now until the end of time. You could also rate and review the show. That would be very helpful and just nice. Thank you very much. If you've got anything you want to tell us, you can email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.